Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for today's interview with John Meese, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Stellenbosch University, South Africa. His book, How to Write a PhD in Biological Sciences, A Guide for the Uninitiated, was published by CRC Press this year. And the book is being written in Bookdown, and so is a live project that anyone may contribute to or use as the basis for their own book. Find out how on the blog post for this episode of Scholarly Communication. This book is part of an advisor. John Meese tells us how the book began life as a blog because he'd found himself repeating the same advice again and again to the PhD students he advised. This book is part of this advisor, John Meese, among whose academic qualities, obviously, is the trait, cares about the people he advises. This book is also part John, because readers can hear his voice in the book. He writes as he sees things. The reader has the feel that it's an office hour, and the professor is providing valuable advice from his own experience and from his own viewpoint. This is downright useful stuff, the reader understands, because someone has used these tips and explanations, and so these tips and explanations are ready to be used again. Just take one example. Here's John Meese in his own words about storytelling in science. I started thinking about this topic some years back, as I often need to write popular articles that make some of the science that we do more generally accessible. But then I came across the article by Nick Enfield entitled, Our Job as Scientists is to Find the Truth, but We Also Must Be Storytellers. That made me think again. No storytelling is a comment that I sometimes make when reading drafts of manuscripts, chapters, and even when editing for journals. What do I mean by this? Stories are deterministic. That is to say that a storyteller has an end in mind when they start telling the story, and the telling is a way of getting their goal across. A story that's pointless will frustrate the audience and won't engender them to listen to that storyteller again. In a good story, reaching that goal will often result in lots of twists and turns, with the goal shrouded in mystery until it is revealed. In a teaching story, like a parable, the goal may be overt, such that the audience relates to the narrative and buys into the same conclusion. If we did science like we tell stories, we would decide on the way the system works before we studied it, and then design the experiment in order to reach our desired goal. You should have recognized by now that this is not the way to do science. This is clearly an undesirable way to go about doing science because we should never prejudice the results that we'll get from a study before we do it. Hence, writing stories and writing science are different processes. That is John Meese from his book, How to Write a PhD in Biological Sciences. This is John Meese on Scholarly Communication. Hi, John. Welcome.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks very much for your introduction. It's very kind.
There's really two places we could pick up. Being the host, I'll decide. It's the story bit in science, the storytelling. This article that you reference here by Nick Enfield is also quite interesting because it weighs up both sides of the issue. The classic complication end of a story, the act of narrating it in an interesting way, and the fact that the narrator seems to have some sort of omnipresence, some control over what's going on. And then, of course, all the things that make that sort of an approach non-scientific, much as you've just said in the quote that I brought up. But Enfield's point is that, nonetheless, we're kind of stuck storytelling. I wonder if you could maybe give us a little bit more precisely your views on this question.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, you know, the way that we communicate is obviously very prone towards storytelling, because that's our history, that's where we've come from. But at the same, and in the way that we communicate science, we can do this by standing up in front of an audience, but we can also do it by writing what we found in a scholarly communication, commonly known as a journal article or a paper. And in that format, we need to be extremely careful, because we don't want, as you said in the quote, we don't want it to come across as a deterministic piece. So something where we already decided at the beginning what was going to happen. But so we need to be careful in how we create that. But at the same time, and what I go on to say in that particular chapter is that we definitely do want to use the tools of storytelling, because they are a way to captivate our audience. And everything we write, you're going to want to keep your audience captive. You're going to want to keep them engaged. And so the rules of storytelling, or some of the tips and tricks of storytelling, are extremely pertinent to us as scientists when we come to write.
I wonder if, because you talk also in that chapter, and Nick Enfield in his Guardian article also talks about this problem of communicating and the difficulty that very many scientists face when they go to then write down their study. It would seem to me, as someone who's coming at science from the writing end, I'm not a scientist myself, as my listeners will know, but I am a English for academic purposes specialist, so I see it through the language lens. It would seem to me that the problem of communicating is precisely in the communicating. It's very possible to see language as having evolved to allow us to connect with other people, to make sense of our experience and other such features of the world as filtered through our communication capabilities, so that it's just absolutely necessary that if you go to communicate anything, science included, and go to write it, you're faced with a tool, a mechanism for doing that doesn't match up one-to-one with the tools, methods of science itself.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I might think that science itself, the communication is very much part of science and is not a separate part, because it doesn't exist or hasn't happened until you've written it down and communicated it. So I think the writing is an integral part of the science. But I take your point that really we have to, it's something that we have to do, something that we, perhaps the more important point is that we're not trained to do it in the way that we might. And that's really at the heart of the book. And the idea for the book is that there is this assumed knowledge. So when you go to a university to do a PhD, your PhD advisor will assume that you know how to communicate. They'll assume that you know how to write, and they'll assume that you've been trained in all these things before. And yet, there are very few courses, although it is becoming increasingly popular, to teach people the rudiments of writing. Back in the day when I did my PhD and did my school studies, we didn't get any formal instruction in how to write. And so really the idea behind this book is to give some very general and some quite basic ideas on how to formulate writing. And these are not really all my own ideas. These are things that I've pulled, and also the experience I've had in teaching other PhD students. But basically to pull them all together in one place and give readers, you said it was very, very short and explicit information about these different ideas, but really my aim is to point them off in other directions where they might find more information. And so they'll find all the chapters are very, very short. They just give a general overview, and then they'll point you off somewhere where you can find more information about this, should you need to read more about it.
Yeah, you give us there a nice insight into the format of the book, and make very clear also the purpose of the book. And I, in my line of work, welcome such a book as this. I find the book also unique in that respect, because, as I was saying before, the other thing I wanted to bring up was your voice. You do give this the feel of, you know, an office hour. You get as a reader the very clear your message coming through, your opinions on things, and what you think will work and won't work. And just as you've said, you very often send the reader out back to his or her advisor, out into the internet to find this or that resource. So perhaps we'll just follow right up with that as to the format of the book. This idea that you very often do have short sections, subsections, you pick up points, give some interesting information about it, send people off to other sources that can be very useful, are often telling them where at their own university they're likely to have their support for this or that question. Perhaps you could speak to the format of the book in respect as to how you filled it, and also what it is. I mentioned book down as being the technical format that it's written in. So if you could take up those two topics, that might be useful.
Sure. Well, I guess any book is a journey. And this has been a journey for me, in that the concept or the idea for all of these chapters originally came about as blog entries. So I have a blog. I would notice that students often have the same issues, and so I'd write a blog about the particular issue. And then those, I think it was late in 2019, I was looking through this blog, and I'd assembled a page which had direct links to various different things, and I realized that, look, there's very nearly a whole book here. And so what I set about doing is trying to fill in those gaps that were missing in the blog articles, and then put them all together into a manuscript. So that's where the idea for the book came from. I think the format is that personally, I don't want to read a big book. I want to be able to get very quickly to the particular issue that I'm stuck with, whether that's how to formulate an argument, or whether it's a particular Latin phrase that I have no clue that somebody's written down on a manuscript. And I want to be able to just quickly jump to those things, find out what they mean. If I can't get a clear idea in a couple of pages, then I'd want to be bounced on somewhere further. So that's really, I mean, I assume that for other people it's the same, and it may not be. And so if you're somebody who likes to sit down and read a good tome from beginning to end about writing, then there are such books out there. There's such vehicles for that sort of thing. But this book won't be that book. So this book is very much dipping in and then providing links to move forward with that kind of thing. And you mentioned book down, and book down for me is very important in this respect. So as I was finishing this book and trying to put it together into a single piece, what I really wanted is something that could be open access. It could sit on a platform, and it could be accessed by anyone. And there are a number of different ways that you can do this. You can have a PDF that sits on your site, something like that, and try and disseminate it. But these are not particularly friendly ways of producing books. And so it was that I came across something called Bookdown. If your listeners are interested in learning more about Bookdown, they can go to bookdown.org read all about it there and read about the project. It's basically the brainchild of the people who produce R Studio, and it utilizes very simple word processing code that you can write in a simple text file, but also you can write in R Studio, and eventually when you come to publish your book on Bookdown, it basically produces a very good structure for the book. It has the entire index down the left-hand side. The book is searchable using a simple text search, but it will produce every chapter that has that bit of text in it. You can change the font, and you can change whether it's black or white at the back, and you can also download the book in different formats onto your desktop, and it sits like that. It's extremely simple for someone like it to take a bit of a learning curve to learn how to do it all, but it's relatively simple and straightforward in order to write using it. But the joy of Bookdown really is that, as you may be aware, a project like this one, it's not a static thing. So there is a book, and it looks like this, but it's a constantly changing field. New things will come up, old things will fall away, and so this is it's a very dynamic system. And what we want is a platform that's equally dynamic in order to put this on. And Bookdown really responds to that. So I have all of my Bookdown book is related to GitHub. So all the files of the book sit on GitHub. For those of your viewers who are familiar with GitHub, then you know that you can produce a pull request. So if you see an error, or if you want to rewrite something to make it more clear, or if you have ideas for other chapters, then you can make this pull request where you can get the source files and change the source files, send them back to the author, and if they approve, it can be up within seconds of receiving it. So there's the ability in Bookdown to make this a very flexible and dynamic product that can change, and has already changed. So if you go to the Bookdown site for this book, which is howtowriteaphd.org, all one word, .org at the end, then you can find extra chapters that have been written that are not in the printed version to date.
I think that's also really worth emphasizing, this format of the book, because it is literally taking the book as we know it in a new direction. It doesn't surprise me that it's coming from the hand of a scientist. I mean, this is clearly by a scientist and for other scientists or people studying to become scientists. It has nothing to do with the humanities. And I have interviewed here on this program many times people who have written very good writing guides. But this writing guide is different for that reason, that it's been written clearly not only by a practitioner. I've also had scientists who've written writing guides, very good ones, but it's written also with a view to how science actually works, this collaborative nature, this we're in a dynamic field, we have to keep a pace. You know, what I write in 2022, forget about it in 2025. Right. I mean, and that's why I want to emphasize that issue, because I find that is definitely a wonderful project. I'm glad you started it.
Yeah, that's very much the case. And I agree that I hope in a way that I've started this. I really hope that I'm not going to be the one that finishes this project, and that it will actually continue on, and that other people will take it up and move with it. Because what I've written so far is, if you like, the stub of an article or of several articles, and there's a lot more to write. There's plenty more to write on this subject, and there's probably much better ways of writing it and alternative views, and all of these can be adapted into this Bookdown product. Bookdown itself has evolved in the 2 years that I've been using it, and will continue to evolve, and will continue to be to provide more different tools for doing different things. And so there's lots of potential for making the book more dynamic, making it more interactive, for graphs that you can change the data with, because obviously this format being produced by R Studio is linked very closely to R. So you can produce graphs, or you can produce data in R that people can then play with within the book. So there's a lot to do, and I would emphasize that, look, I'm not the first person to write a book in Bookdown. There are hundreds of books already there. And I think that's one of the things that I refer to in this book. I mean, one of the inspirations for this book was other books about how to produce figures, for example. So there's lots of books already on Bookdown about producing figures and doing statistics. And so you won't find those sections of this book particularly well extensively written. They instead pass you on to other books that are also open access. So again, one of the ideas for this book is really to provide content that people can then move on to and use the internet in the way that it should be used to gain further knowledge and gain more insight about the issues and the problems that you have.
I guess to move from this innovative format back to the conventional, which I'm holding right here in my hand, the book itself, you mentioned earlier that, of course, the point of the book is to provide training or to provide advice to PhDs who are getting started with their studies, who are in the writing process, wherever they happen to be, preferably very early on, as is made clear in the book. But I'm holding the book here in front of me this way because of the picture on the front. Now, I think it may have been one other time in all the years I've been doing this that I've actually commented on the picture on an academic book. But this one is worth doing because of the title and also what we find above that. We find here a dragon, a princess apparently holding the dragon on a sort of leash, as far as I could see. And then, of course, the student is on top of a knight, dressed as a knight, on top of the a horse, driving a lance into the dragon's head. The dragon is labeled as the PhD. It's it's a very subtle sort of humor. And it's carrying a message, though, too, because that's what brings me to the title itself, right? So how to write this PhD, but then the guide for the uninitiated. And this is something you mentioned earlier, that, right, there's a lot of assumptions, inexplicitness, a lot of just sort of don't ask questions, follow my lead kind of thing going on in academia. And you very rightly want to help put an end to that, because what purpose does that serve, right?
Yeah, so I guess that, you know, this is also my backstory, in that I felt that I came to, when I started my PhD, the context, I'm British, I'm from the UK. You don't have to do a master's study before you do a PhD, and I didn't. So I came from an honors program, and I found myself in a situation at a new institution, a new university, where there was a lot of assumed knowledge, and I had an advisor that didn't have any time to fill me in on the knowledge that he assumed that I'd had, and I think that's very common. I think that's very common for a lot of students. They'll start a PhD in a novel situation. The person that they are working with has only a very limited amount of time. And so the idea of covering what they might consider to be basics is perhaps the last thing they want to do, and what they really want to do is move on with the particular science and the particular question that they have. And so that's where I find myself, and I suppose it's only, 20-odd years later, maybe more like 30 years now, that I can reflect on how that was for me and produce. And this is exactly what I would have wanted to have had back in those days when I was starting the PhD, is somebody telling me, okay, well, you know, this is what it's about. This is what everyone else knows, but that you're missing because you didn't have that kind of that particular education. And so for many students, the PhD becomes like this beast, this dragon, as it's portrayed on the cover. It becomes something that they some fearful monster that they have to slay over their 3 years, and it can, for some people, it can get bigger, bigger and more overwhelming the more they come up against this thesis that they have to produce. And so the guide is perhaps the lance in this case. I think that's what it's labeled as, the guide. Yes, the lance. It's a way in which it will help you to slay the dragon, or it will help you produce that PhD. But it's not going to do the science for you. It's not going to write it for you. You're still going to have to do all that yourself. It's just going to be one of the tools in your toolkit. To help get it done.
And that's what I certainly very much picked up as you were, as I said in the introduction, as you were conceiving of this project, it clearly even began as literally advice to people you were advising. You've told us and tell us also in the book, but that comes out clearly, and I think that's the voice that students are going to be looking for. And also the format, the fact that you can dip in and dip out. I mean, that I think that's pre-programmed to be successful with scientists who are used to reading more snippets rather than entire books, right? I mean, the entire book is never actually going to help you with all with the part question that you might have on your particular project at this moment. But the sections will, very much so. And what comes out is just one insight after another, where I can see that your motivation was true. You were really trying to just blow away this fog. When you say, for example, you know, you'll find that very many examiners are going to be treating the actual PhD as an extra large task in peer review.
Yep.
I don't think that very many students would have imagined that, but for me, it was immediately extremely helpful. I realized, okay, and to know the mindset of your readers is obviously gold, isn't it?
Yep.
When you tell us in chapter 2, there's also there's again subtle humor, but a lot of really important information being passed on there. So to reconcile yourself to doing things that you've been avoiding. And one of these implied appears to be, amongst others, you talk there about understanding your statistics, understanding the software you're going to use, but also facing writing and communicating, which is not something that perhaps is first on people's minds when they start the PhD.
Yeah, I would have thought that this is very similar across the board with PhDs, but I know it's so in biological sciences, is that when you come to do a PhD, it's because you have an enthusiasm for the subject, right? And you want to spend more time. You've got a taster for research, but you want to spend more time doing research. And perhaps you don't have the understanding at that point that the research is only the front part, and that the communication is actually part of that research. So that this part, this essential part of it that's bolted on, that what I really want people to know for having read this book or having dipped into it is it's something that you must start building up right from the beginning. So I think too often I hear people putting off the writing and say, oh, no, I'll do that at the, I'm planning to do that at the end of the PhD. And that's basically a disaster waiting to happen right at the end, when they'll find that they quickly run out of time and they will have it'll be too late to note down some things. But really, one of the messages in this book is how to actually integrate the writing part of the PhD together with the research part. So how to integrate writing and studying together at the same time. Because that's, I think it's a much more fulfilling way of doing the writing. And I think it's certainly a better model for use of your time.
Yeah, and this is also to come back to what you were saying earlier. I mean, if you put off the writing, it's also a misrecognition of the role that the writing actually has in science. I wholeheartedly agree, as you said before, that you know, just to separate out the communicating from the science itself is not a task that's really going to pay back much. You know, I mean, where do you draw the line between one and the other? And in a sense, as you're probably saying right now, the sooner you recognize that and act on that, there you'll find the payback. I found one of the sort of central messages that recurred throughout in so many different formats, no matter what you were talking about in the book.
Yeah, so I think that's part of the story, but I think the other part is that we're in a very interesting time when it comes to being a scientist or being an academic even, and publishing your research. So we're at an extremely interesting time because the potential that we have to not just publish what we've written, which is where we used to be with scholarly journals, we'd just have the articles, we'd have the pre-digested data, if you like, in the form of tables and figures. But now we're at a moment where we can actually put all the data out there. We can put all of the code that we wrote so that people can repeat the analysis. And in a way, the writing that we're doing is to communicate our particular understanding of where we're posing the questions and where we're interested in particular parts of the data set. But it's also a means of not just communicating the particular questions that we have then, but also of producing and advertising the data set for other people to use. So I think we are starting to enter this very dynamic period in publishing whereby the actual article will be one of many products that we produce in the research that we do. And I've tried to touch on this in this book, but it's more, there's a lot more information on this in another book, which is the sort of sequel to this book called How to Publish in Biological Sciences. This is also a guide for the uninitiated. It's also on Bookdown. It's also completely open access, so you can read that now at howtopublishscience.org. But it will also be a solid book, also published by CRC. And I've just been going through the proofs in the past couple of days, so we'll be hopefully looking at that coming out in May. Taking that approach forward then, in publishing, then we'll be producing a whole range of products, and the communication in the writing will be in addition to communication in code, for example. So when you're writing your R script, you'll now be writing a public R script for your analysis, or Python or whatever particular code you're writing in. But that will be also a product that you'll be putting online. Your data set will be another product that you'll be putting online, and you will be hoping that people use it. You won't be trying to hide it as people have done in the past, but you'll actually be putting it out there. So you will have this dynamic range of products that you will be hoping people use to build this scientific project.
That's a fantastic insight into what is actually going on in writing in the sciences right now. And you tease that out wonderfully. You've got, yes, the writing is part of the research on the one hand, but this writing is also in flux now. It's changing, and what that means and what's part of the finished product. Fantastic. Great stuff. And I think that's one of the things I would like to talk briefly about writing style. It is one of your chapters. And it's also caught up in both of these issues that you're talking about right now. The idea that it's more than just the research article that's being written, and the writing is more than you think it is. It's very interesting. First off, you give the perspective of the uninitiated to start off the chapter, telling us that, yeah, you had originally thought, as I think the vast majority of science students do think, that the writing is meant to be a sort of puzzle, and that you prove your capability in the science by teasing it out and solving the puzzle. And clearly it's much the opposite, that the goal of the writer should be, and that you should really actually be communicating clearly and not leaving up to the reader this sort of solving issue. I found that wonderful. But what I found really even fantastic was you talk, for instance, about Steven Pinker, but I mean, he stands for so many other writing guides that are out there. These sorts of guides may well be useful for their audience, but they may also be overestimating how large that audience is. And that I found really was eye-opening. You refer to an article there by, I only have the last name here, Plaxico, and how you show that, no, it's this isn't really about writing it so everyone understands it. This is more about deciding whom you're writing to and creating, if you like, high performance prose so that the writer's meaning meets the reader's understanding.
Yeah, so I think know your audience is something that you're going to hear whenever you hear anyone talking about writing. You're going to, the first question that you need to ask them is, well, who are you writing it for? And that's no different in science. And the particular way in which you craft your prose for your chapter or your article, your manuscript, is going to be particular to the audience that particular journal that you're planning to send it to will have. I think so just to go back and tell you the anecdote behind this puzzle. I greatly enjoyed the reading part of my PhD, and I used to have these tomes, and they were almost always by single authors, and you would read it once and you would get something out of it. You think, oh, okay, well, but I needed to read it again in order to, there must be something more to this. And then after maybe three or four readings and lots of notes, you realize, this is what they were trying to say, maybe. And this is how these parts of the puzzle all put together. And then later on, as an editor, I came across a manuscript that had been submitted, read very, very in a similar way. I reached out to the person. I knew the person personally. I reached out to them and I said, look, the way you've written this is like a puzzle. And what you want is the reader to put all of these different graphs and your results. And you want them to fit it all together and spend their time trying to work out what you're trying to say. And the guy said to me, yes, that's exactly what I want. The reader must do the work. And I think, you know, for me, that's where we've come from. So that is very much the style of mid and even late 20th century science writing, is to produce these puzzles and to produce all the information there and let the reader be sufficiently scholarly to understand it. But the things have changed. We can't possibly communicate like that to an audience anymore, because our audience has too much to read. They can't afford to read everything four times in order to get what the information is. We need to be giving it to them. So we need to change that puzzle around and change it from being a puzzle into producing what is going to be the most beautiful looking plate of food, if you like, for our readers to consume. So we've got to produce it in a way that it's easiest for them to consume it, not so that they have to put it together before they can actually understand any of it. And that's fundamental, I think, now to writing. And I mentioned Steven Pinker because some time ago, he said that, you know, scientists are really bad at writing, and they have been in the past. But actually, the good news now is that there are lots of great role models for modern scientists and for PhD students. There are many, many articles that are very well written. And what I encourage readers to do in the book is to make notes about which of the articles are good to read. So when they read an article and they recognize that it's good, then make notes about that. See if you can start teasing apart why you think it's good. And then there's some tools in the book to try and help do that. Because there are lots of different reasons why people can write well, and there's not one way of doing any of these things. But to actually be able to say, okay, well, yes, it's because they did this, or because they did that, that actually the article came across as very easy to read or very nice to read. And then to look for those clues, because once you've recognized a style that you like in other people, I think it makes it easier to actually then incorporate some of that style into your own writing.
And the other thing that you make clear is that the literature, you have a number of sections, even two chapters on why it is critical that you read, not just for the research purposes, but for the writing purposes, as you're making clear to us, but also, again, for the research purposes in ways that might not entirely be clear to most PhD students, perhaps even some postdocs. One example that springs to mind is you can use the literature, I was noticing, as a sort of second advisor when you have questions about, okay, well, what was their context? Or in specific, I remember, okay, I've got this hypothesis. I'm trying to work out how to test it. Well, how did other people test similar hypotheses? So comb through the materials and methods and, look for their procedure, look for their materials, figure out how they put it together and adapt it to your needs. So, I mean, the literature has so much to offer, and it's, just looking for the facts in there is such a waste in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's correct. There are lots of different levels that writers are operating on, and I guess that's part of the story of this book is to give you insight. So once you've understood that there's more than just producing the graph and writing about what's on the graph, there's so much more behind it. But unless you have read critically, so I think I talk about critical reading. So, and unless you have approached your reading in a critical way in order to look at making notes on the style, highlighting, doing things like highlighting a logical argument and seeing how they make that, breaking it down, looking at the different parts. Or whether or not they use the standard formula. I mean, this book takes this idea of writing to a particular formula, It's not something everyone likes, but it's certainly the easiest way to approach writing in biological sciences. But looking for times when people have broken that formula is also a fascinating insight into what makes an article very good or very easy to read or easy to understand. And of course, converse is also true, right? So when you get a real stinker and when you get an article that you don't like or you don't think is well written, again, you know, have that critical reading to think, well, why is it, what's gone wrong here? What haven't they done? That will help you in your own writing, but it will also help you for your career in terms of being able to pinpoint exactly why a manuscript you might be reviewing, for example, doesn't seem good to you. We, in science, we have this peer review. Peer review is very important for our system. It's this sort of silver bullet that gives a way of having some level of approval of content. But it requires peer reviewers, and we're very short of good peer reviewers. And one of the problems with peer review system is that when you get comments back, they're not hitting the mark because they're reading it in a hurry or because they're not really seeing exactly what the problem is. They don't have that insight. But again, if you learn how to read critically when you're doing your PhD, it will put you in much better stead later on. And, you know, my personal belief is that all of us, being members of the public in today's world, could take a very important lesson about critical reading of content just for life. I think early on in the book, I talk about the Baloney Toolkit.
That's right. Yeah, Carl Sagan, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So Carl Sagan put this together, and he called it when to spot baloney. I call it something like when to know what you smell is bullshit, or something very similar. But yes, yeah, so, you know, the critical reading is an important skill, not just for science, but for everything you read and consume in the world about you.
I think at the close here, I'd like to just return once more to the really basic purpose of the book, as it announces in its title. It's there for the PhD students. It's there to offer them something that they may not be getting because of these mystification processes that happen so often in academia. I know from my end, again, as a writing professional, that it is very often the case that academics, and you have a lot to say about academics and academia in the book. I'll just leave that as a teaser for people to listen to. But there are very many who tend to objectify the text types that people are writing during their studies, the literature review or the argumentative essay or the experimental protocol. And what I mean by that is if those were ends in themselves, and what your book opens up is the idea that, you know, these are steps along the way. These are, you know, the beginnings of your career. They're teaching you something, but they don't really count in and of themselves. And I suppose what I'd like to ask is, what is your view in that connection of the entire PhD? I've had people here who work closely in STEM writing talk about the PhD as, I've also listened to Nature's working scientist and heard similar ideas expressed, talking about the PhD as if it also needed to enter this dynamic developing process and be perhaps moved more in a direction of real-world praxis and less academic theory. Maybe and some schools are even doing this. Maybe people need to be publishing immediately a few articles instead of actually putting together chapters in a book, which often then get in some format or another published later on. So I suppose, again, my question to you is more about what does the PhD need to do? What separates it out? What is its educational value if it's not actual publication? Are there things that are gained by having perhaps that slight bit of a screen or wall between the real world before the researcher has finished their studies?
Yeah, some interesting ideas. I think I'd like to start by saying that even though the book is written towards PhD students, anyone who's experiencing the struggle in writing should, for science, especially for the biological sciences, but maybe there's also important lessons here for other areas as well. So I would hope that it's a guide, it's a more encompassing guide than just people who are writing PhDs. So if you are an early career researcher, or if you're a master's student and you're doing master's by research, or if you need to, even if you're an undergraduate and you're writing up a project, then I would hope if writing is a mystery to you, then I would hope that there's some useful information here.
That is entirely the case. I misframed the question to make it seem as if it was only for PhDs. I can say from this reader's perspective that all of those groups you just mentioned certainly will find here what they're looking for.
Thanks. But in terms of is a PhD hitting the mark, and is it useful in terms of what we wanted to produce in society now? I think yes. We should certainly be asking ourselves these questions and finding out whether it's relevant. I think for me, I would say that the discipline of doing a PhD is almost exists in and of itself, because what you're really trying to do is you're having somebody who's studying a subject in obviously in great detail, but the objective there is to have them learn how to ask the questions. And it's not asking any question, but it's asking a question that can be answered, and then putting those steps into place in order to answer that particular question. So it's the nuts and bolts of how to go about doing research. So what we want to produce when we have somebody who's finished a PhD is we want to have somebody who we can say, yes, you know, this person can now not only go forward as a scientist, but this person knows how to approach asking questions in order to answer them. Does that make sense?
Very much so, yes. thank you very much. Thank you for that, John. That is John Meesey. His book, How to Write a PhD in Biological Sciences, A Guide for the Uninitiated, is out with CRC Press now, and it's also open to you and to your collaboration even at Bookdown. Just visit the blog post and you'll find all the links there. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to John. Goodbye.
Thanks very much, Daniel. Goodbye.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.